it's that generational wealth concept, right? You can actually hand a house down from grandpa to son or whatever, and you can do that with Bitcoin. And there's right. so few other assets that are out there that can potentially be more valuable during that type of a process.
Conventional wisdom has always been that you should have a 70-30 portfolio of equities and bonds, right? And then of course your home, but to me that's all changed. You know, there's so much money printing and yields are so low. It doesn't make sense to own bonds anymore at all. And the only two things that can protect you against loose monetary policy by central bankers, including, you know, the US Fed, is owning property, owning Bitcoin, owning real estate, owning art or any other kind of hard asset. Those are the only things that protect you against inflation that's coming.
All right, coming to you once again from the Bitcoin Bottom Line. This is CJ Wilson with Stephen McClurg. And I think this week we are going to be talking about the infrastructure bill, what it means for Bitcoin, Bitcoin miners, what it means for node runners, and just the general aspect of the legislative political involvement in the Bitcoin space. So, Stephen, good to see you again. How have you been? It's been a couple of weeks, I guess, since we've been on.
It's good to see you too, sir. It has been a few weeks, but nice break, and now we're back at it. Fighting the good fight.
Yeah, and speaking of fighting the good fight, it's been a bit of a fight in the Senate the last couple of days. We've been watching, I think, remotely and through a lot of different, like, access to different platforms that I hadn't really been aware of before, because when they included the cryptocurrency, I guess you would say the rider or whatever, into this infrastructure bill, it seems like it's drawn a lot of attention, and a lot of us have been like pretty like rattling our cages pretty hard about trying to get the right thing done. So we were talking a little bit before we started about this, and you were saying, like, just kind of being, if you could kind of give everybody a little bit of a background on what they're asking for, especially for like maybe the miners and stuff like that, because I think that's pretty technical.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and I'll start off by saying, you know, most of my career, I've tried to be apolitical and, you know, figure out what's going on, figure out what's going to happen, and try to work around that. Right. I mean, that's really the only way you can be. And, I think things have changed a little bit in the last few weeks. And, it's caused a lot of us to be a little bit more political and a little bit more, involved, so to speak. But first of all, I think it's really important to talk about what a broker is and what being a broker actually means. And this is something that, you know, I've done in the past. You know, I've had licenses, to be a principal of a broker dealer, in my past. And really, I think what they're trying to get to in this is defining what a broker is in the realm of cryptocurrencies. And really what a broker is in this context is affecting transactions. And what that means is, if you're an investment banker and there are two sides of a deal, right? So you might have a company that's acquiring another company, or a company that is selling debt or selling equity to the public. And the broker is the person that sits in the middle, or the investment banker is the one that sits in the middle and helps affect that transaction. And they do a lot of work, right? They work with lawyers to make sure all the documents are in place. They're KYCing the people that, if it's a security sell, that securities are being sold to. They're doing bad actor checks. There's a lot of things that they're doing in affecting that transaction. But when you're affecting a transaction, essentially you are the person in the middle. You know both sides. You are you're getting paid too, by the way, a percentage of everything that's going through. Could be anywhere from 1 to 10% or higher, depending on what it is. But that's essentially what a broker does, you know, sell securities, sits in the middle of a transaction.
So kind of like a real estate agent where they're going to be making sure that their client is protected or both sides are protected in terms of the overall deal flow. The funny thing is that cryptocurrency, for the most part, is kind of a DIY thing, right? Like if you're going to go buy something, you've already done some sort of KYC because you've signed up to an exchange or something like that, right? So you're like, oh, today's the day I buy $1,000 worth of Bitcoin, and you log in to whatever, you know, onboarded program you have, and boop, you hit the $1,000. So there's not like, usually there's not a third party, right? It's an open market of a bid and an ask, and you fulfill a market order or you put in a limit order, and then you sort of custody your own Bitcoin after that. But I think applying the broker like infrastructure that they have for mentally for like a IPO type security or something like that, like you would see before a stock goes public, they're going to have an IPO and a pre-IPO, and you're going to have broker dealers getting involved in terms of slicing up how much of that's going to be available to like certain banks or clients of banks or whatever, right? But this is not the same thing at all to me. I mean, I don't think in terms of the Bitcoin space, like the broker thing, it's a totally bad provision in that regard.
Yeah, I agree. And the definition of broker that they're using is in the definition of a FINRA registered broker dealer dealing in securities. And you actually bring up a really good point in real estate, right? So real estate has real estate agents that work for a broker, and they're brokering the transaction, but it's a different type of broker. It's not a broker dealer. It's a real estate broker, and they're exempted from these FINRA rules. And the reason why is because a real estate transaction isn't a securities transaction. Real estate is property, and property is exempted. Now, Bitcoin, according to the IRS, is considered property. It's considered digital property. And according to the SEC, it's not a security. So it actually falls within the same rules as real estate would. Therefore, if you are a broker in the realm of Bitcoin, I'm gonna talk specifically about Bitcoin because this is pretty important. Then it should be an exemption, and I think it actually will be. Now let's dig in a little bit deeper. If you're an exchange and you are, dealing in Bitcoin, and let's say you're also dealing in other digital assets, that's separate. But if you're dealing in Bitcoin, you probably should be a broker in the sense of a real estate broker is, right? But you should not have to be a broker in the sense of securities laws. Going one step down into mining, our last podcast was all about mining. But really what a Bitcoin miner does, it's not affecting transactions. And I think even though that this bill, let's say this bill does get passed by the House, it's already passed the Senate. Let's say it gets passed by the House. And then it takes 2 years for this bill to go into effect. Well, I think between now and then, what's going to happen is they're going to realize that, okay, well, number one, Bitcoin is property. It's not a security. It doesn't really fall here. Number two, people will start understanding what a miner actually does. All miners do is validate a transaction, right? They're essentially an auditor. They're not a broker. They're not affecting a transaction. They're just validating the transaction.
So yeah, they come in almost in a way post transaction, because you and I are exchanging. I'm sending you Bitcoin. You're sending me, you know, goods or whatever. Or right. I'm just sending you Bitcoin, and then the Bitcoin blockchain itself is actually accumulating all of those transactions, and the miners are competing to finish the next block, right? So after those transactions have already happened, so they're just basically cataloging everything that's already happened and publishing it. I mean, that's effectively how the nodes and the miners really work in that sense, right? So it's not even like a toll booth where you're like, oh, let me scan your license plate before you drive through. It's not like that. Like they've already driven through and they're like, oh, red car, blue car, red car. That's it. Like that's really how it goes, you know? So yeah. I think it's weird. It's weird, but it's expected that the government would actually get this wrong. And it's not the same as saying, oh, well, you know, if we're going to have a gas tax or a real estate tax or something like that, that's been like a very developed, you know, conversation that they've had over years, electric vehicles or clean air or something like that, which I would say at this point, you'd have to assume that 80 to 90% of the senators understand what those terms mean, but it's the opposite for Bitcoin, right? It's the opposite for cryptocurrency. So that's why it's like,
well, by the way, that's 5%. That's actually pretty good, because I would argue that less than 5% of people that own some type of cryptocurrency actually understand what they're owning.
You know, it's interesting because it's like, you know, I think Bitcoiners have become, you know, we like for a long time, Bitcoiners were sort of just doing their thing, saying, hey, live and let live. We'll stay back. We're going to just kind of develop everything on our own. We're not going to get involved. And this all of a sudden, bam, now everybody wants to get involved. And it's been interesting to see that feedback from the broad, you know, crypto Twitter, Bitcoin Twitter, I guess sphere or whatever, you know.
Yeah. Well, and very specifically, I mean, it, you know, I know, you know, you and a group of people are getting pretty involved out in California. Myself and a group of people are getting pretty involved here in the South. There's another group that's, you know, a couple of groups in DC. I'm curious, you know, what's some of the action that you know, you and Jimmy and some of the other ones have taken, and what has the effect been, and you know, and where do you think we go from here?
Well, I think something that we bring up a lot in private conversation, this is just like something that, you know, you'll have a couple of Bitcoiners talk to each other, whether it's through DMs or Telegram or, you know, WhatsApp or whatever, or at, you know, at conferences, at meetups. Bitcoin is kind of like Fight Club in a way, right? Like, it's decentralized in the sense that there's like a Fight Club over here and a Fight Club over here. So there's these Bitcoin meetups that are happening all over the place. And I think once you get everybody on this kind of parallel thought process, in terms of a lot of people that are Bitcoiners have a good sense of what they want to see happen and how they want to see Bitcoin as a standard sort of roll out, and how they see that being positive for savings or positive for the economy or positive for jobs. And, you know, we've talked about a lot of those things with El Salvador, with, you know, human rights and things like that. And so when you get the guys that are very involved in the space, the Jimmy Songs and the Parker Lewis's and the, you know, the Jameson Lopps and the Adam Backs and all these other people that have done a lot of stuff, or Jan Pritzker, Corey Klipstein, that have either their own exchange or their own onboarding process or their own company or something like that. A lot of them, I mean, Bitcoin is their job, right? So they have this very serious, like, much deeper than me as a car dealer that's a Bitcoin aficionado, you know, kind of guy. They have this much deeper connection to it. And then you have this whole other layer of people that are sort of very politically aware and then have good connections to, let's say, lobbyists or potentially even congressional people or local mayors or whatever it is. And so you're seeing this outreach happen where, you know, Suarez from Miami, Greg Abbott in Texas, Conger, I believe, is that the guy in Tennessee, Warren Davidson, Cynthia Lummis. So you're seeing these politicians actually go on Twitter, go on Clubhouse, go on Twitter Spaces, and participate in conversations about Bitcoin and about cryptocurrency and about like how this could potentially be a great thing for Wyoming or Texas or anywhere, Nashville. So we recently had an opportunity to talk to somebody that had gone on a Fox News show and said, hey, I'd love to learn more about Bitcoin. And so like a bunch of us got together and said, well, hey, why don't we just reach out to this guy and talk to him? And that was Ted Cruz. So a couple weeks ago, we reached out to him through, I mean, this is maybe like 6 or 8 weeks ago, we had initiated the process. And then it just so happened that the infrastructure bill kind of went in. And then all of a sudden we had our Zoom meeting like the next day. And so it was very interesting because we had not, obviously no one had really seen the infrastructure bill coming in terms of like having this sort of cryptocurrency component to it. So I think for the most part, Parker and Jimmy, who are fantastic, they're also in Texas. And there's another guy named Christopher that's part of the Texas Blockchain Association or coalition. And sort of they were talking to him about how, you know, Texas is a mining center, Texas, because of the natural gas thing. You know, there's a lot of oil and natural gas that can be used instead of flared to run Bitcoin mines. There's Bitcoin companies developing in Texas. And he was all about it. He thought it was really cool because he said, okay, well, you know, Silicon Valley kind of failed in this, in the idea that they were going to sort of change the world from this perspective of software and, you know, human rights and whatever. And that turned into sort of like a, you know, Ted's obviously Republican. It sort of turned into like a lefty, you know, regressive area where now you have big tech that's trying to like limit people, censor people, stuff like that. So obviously, you know, so Bitcoin's sort of the opposite direction. Bitcoin's freedom, Bitcoin's savings. It's all these other things. It's sort of the pleb network, you know, of people that have, let's say 0.1 Bitcoin or more. Those people are all getting very involved, and because they now see Bitcoin as having this potential and going up and being something that they can routinely put savings into because the dollar value sucks and the erosion of the dollar with inflation and all that stuff. So it was a very quick conversation. He's obviously very, very close with Cynthia Lummis. Cynthia Lummis is obviously very educated on Bitcoin. And so, you know, her amendment, I think, was a direct result of her knowledge and trying to strike some of these antiquated broker kind of terms from the thing to exclude, you know, proof of work miners and things like that, because that's obviously not, like you said, it really is not a broker. You know, someone that's a miner or a node runner is not really a broker. And you know, it's very funny because the Senate is very equally divided, right? And so having 5 or 10 people that are sort of like all Bitcoin aware can really make a difference in the vote. And it's one of the reasons why we talked about starting, you know, a sort of outreach program to for both sides, bipartisan, right? Like you're a Democrat, you're a Republican, it doesn't matter. We'd love to give you the actual information. They understand that it's Bitcoin mining is great to have in America, and it's great to have Americans that are actually Bitcoiners, because the prosperity involved of an American Bitcoiner is if their savings go up, they're going to spend more, they're going to be less likely to default on loans and things like that, which is really, I think, the biggest problem that we've had in the economy is when you have this like sort of wonky asset, you know, mix, and then you have default risk. Because it's when companies and people default, that's when it really creates these problems with bailouts and all that other stuff. And that's really where, you know, then you need to have the government printing come in. And I think that broad picture, you know, was I think pretty effective at explaining to Ted. But he's a very sharp guy, and he had to go do some sort of a vote in the middle of the, so he like runs off. He's like, okay, I'll be back in 8 minutes. And it's like runs back and comes back. So it's kind of interesting. I mean, it was, I think, a cool process, but I think there's a lot more congressional appointees and senators that are interested because they've seen how much attention this has drummed up. Now, I think the wheels are spinning on their head thinking, okay, how can this be good for my state? How can this be good for me to get reelected? You know, and how can this be good for the economy or whatever else that they're getting down that checklist? So there's a bunch of us that are actually like in contact and trying to provide this information. Hopefully for the benefit of all holders of cryptocurrency and especially Bitcoin.
Yeah. Well, by the way, I actually liked Ted Cruz's proposal better than everybody else's. You know, what is this doing in an infrastructure bill that's supposed to improve American infrastructure, but it's actually something that limits infrastructure?
Yeah, it limits development.
For sure at all. Right.
Right. So, and limits potentially limits, you know, the outreach or the development of the industry, which is crazy because, you know, anytime America, I mean, if you're a senator, you have to be thinking like America, right? America and your state, those are the two most important things that you need to be thinking right. about. And if you limit the future revenue of your state, you're limiting the tax revenue of your state, like GERP.
That's right.
And then if you're limiting the American revenue and the American development, then you're also hurting America because you're giving some other country a chance to come up and take your seat at the table, you know, which right. those are the two things that all these senators need to be focused on.
I mean, China just gave us a gift on a golden platter. We should be taking it, not sending it back. And it's really disappointing that a few people don't see it that way, but even here in Tennessee, you know, both Senators Blackburn and Hagerty are very pro Bitcoin and are doing everything they can too. You know, they're also trying to understand it, right? Hagerty probably understands it. Hagerty actually probably understands it better than a lot of other senators as well. And he's on the finance committee. So, which is pretty positive.
So have you tried to kind of reach out as a new Nashvillian, to get a hold of them?
I've been talking to several folks. But I've been trying to talk to both Democrats and Republicans. Hagerty and Blackburn are both Republicans. But I think it seems like more Republicans are in than Democrats. So I think it's important that we also speak to a lot of Democratic senators as well. And then, of course, in Congress, we have, Warren Davidson is probably the most outspoken person there on freedoms in general, but financial freedom and he's a good libertarian.
Yeah, I think it's a really critical time for us as an industry and, as a country, because like you said, the gift that China's given us in terms of basically blocking their own citizens from hopping in deeper into the game, into the Bitcoin game. It gives us a chance as Americans to, I would say, mine more Bitcoin, number one. And I think that's great. Anytime you can get more Bitcoin is better. With the difficulty adjustment going down recently, it's basically made anybody that has stayed active on the network more successful, getting more chances or more Bitcoin or whatever. But it comes down to like the freedom aspect, right? Mm-hmm. And the future aspect, right? Because with the let's say compound annual growth rate that Bitcoin has put together in the last dozen years, or any kind of metric that you're looking at the value, right? There's almost no other thing that's out there besides potentially owning Amazon stock 20 years ago or Apple stock 20 years ago that has the ability to sort of solidify your future that Bitcoin does, right? I mean, Bitcoin has such because of the scarcity and all these other aspects of it that basically allow it to spread across the network in a stronger way. It gives almost everybody a chance to put in incremental dollars and get outsized returns or just get, outsized buying power years from now, right? And I think that's the one thing that we constantly talk about. And in a hopeful way to say that if we get more people involved in this, and I think the idea that when you're talking to the Democratic, congressional people or mayors or senators or whatever, is to say, hey, listen, there's a lot of big businesses that are parasitically or vampirically denying the lower class or the lower middle class a chance to sort of have upward mobility or increased buying power. And Bitcoin fixes that because you have an aspect of like, it doesn't cost anything to custody. So if you put $5,000 in your savings account or your checking account at one of these big banks, it's not enough money for them to not charge you the $20 a month, right? Or $40 a month or whatever it is. Whereas Bitcoin doesn't really have that drag, that parasitic drag, right? And then not only that, it's because nobody can print more of it, the value of Bitcoin versus the dollar allows for, Bitcoin priced mentality and Satoshi priced mentality so that you're looking at saying, oh, well, if a house a couple of years ago would have cost me 400 Bitcoin, now a house can cost me, 7 Bitcoin or something like that. And eventually a house might only cost 1 Bitcoin. So if whatever you have in your Bitcoin holdings today could potentially be the down payment for your house in the future or something like that. Right. We talk about home ownership and things as a sort of a route out of, I don't want to call it poverty, but basically to get to the next level, whatever that next level is. And I think that's something that has been very effective when we've been communicating with the Democrats, because I think they, in general, I think Democrats, if you look at the sort of social spread, they're representing, the wider group of people, and the Republicans a lot of times are representing an incumbency or a big business or something like that in a way. And so Bitcoin kind of represents anybody and everybody that wants to be on the team. And so you see these people that have become really like gone from, you're seeing venture capitalists that are saying, I'm a single issue voter. I will move based on the Bitcoin policies of the state. I will move to a new country if I have to based on Bitcoin or whatever else. And I think that rings a really big dinner bell for a lot of these political people, because they realize, oh, wow, this is potentially a huge deal that is going to have to get, on a debate stage. It's going to have to get addressed by both candidates, regardless of which one is the actual winner, right? It's going to have to be addressed openly. It's going to have to be whether it's, you know, and there's all these other laws and rights and stuff like that, that have kind of come up in the last 30 or 40 years that have been, I would say at first a very dividing thing and then eventually adopted by everybody. Right.
Yeah,
to the point where, so I think that's the future. And it's kind of exciting to see the door opening to that, because the fact that these people who in a way are sort of, even though we vote them into office, they don't necessarily represent us on a direct basis. But I think in this case, we, as people that are educated in the space, have a chance to educate them and give them the tools so that they're giving Bitcoin proper representation, you know, legally and all that stuff. And I think that's, but it's also pretty funny when you read these tweets that it's like Janet Yellen is the reason why this is in there. Janet Yellen's calling senators and Janet Yellen's involved. And it's kind of like, okay, all right. So this is even it's even worse than we thought in that regard, you know?
Yeah. Well, you actually brought up a really good point a minute ago, and you were talking about home ownership and how important that is. Well, remember at the beginning of this, we were talking about property, right? Bitcoin is property. It's taxed as property. It should look and act like property in the same way that real estate does. And it's something that gives people the ability to own something that can appreciate.
It's that generational wealth concept, right? You can actually hand a house down from grandpa to son or whatever. And you can do that with Bitcoin. And there's so few other assets that are out there that can potentially be more valuable during that type of a process, right?
But by the way, the only two things that I'm interested in owning right now is real estate and Bitcoin, right? I mean, you know, the conventional wisdom has always been that you should have a 70-30 portfolio of equities and bonds, right? And then of course your home. But to me, that's all changed. You know, there's so much money printing and yields are so low. It doesn't make sense to own bonds anymore at all. And the only two things that can protect you against, you know, loose monetary policy by central bankers, including, you know, the US Fed, is owning property, owning Bitcoin, owning real estate, owning art or any other kind of hard asset. Those are the only things that protect you against inflation that's coming. I mean, inflation has been coming for the last 12 years, right? When we, you know, challenged conventional monetary policy back in 2008 and 2009 with helicopter money, and we've continued to do it over the following decade, and then did it again a year ago. You know, all of this leads to inflation. Sometimes it takes time to get there, but it does lead there. I mean, this is why the stock market has rallied as much as it has over a year.
Yeah, it's not the fundamental success. It's not the fundamental success in real terms of these companies that's driven these valuations up, right? I mean, in terms of their stock price, it's definitely a fact that there's all this. It's like you have this huge like water balloon. Okay. And then all that water has to go into other things. Otherwise, it's not just going to evaporate. And I think that's the issue that a lot of people don't see in terms of inflation. It's that when the money gets plopped into the system, that liquidity gets plopped in, it's like you're tightening up a waterbed because you're putting more water in it. Right. So the phrase of like the rising tide lifts all boats, in this regard, the rising money supply lifts all companies or whatever else, even zombie companies that aren't successful, that are basically just treading water. If they're treading water, now they're treading water at a higher level, right? Because there's more water underneath them. There's
and
more
these
stuff.
Zombie companies, I mean, they've been going for over 10 years now because, you know, lending, you know, money's cheap and there's a lot of it, right? I mean, look how long Sears and Toys R Us lasted beyond its expiration date.
Now it's even weirder. It's even weirder now because you have all these degenerate day traders from Reddit and stuff like that that are actually like trading these companies that are defunct because they're playing these crazy games against the hedge funds. And so you have short squeezes and all these other things that are happening because the zombie company is the information about the zombie company is so public that the hedge funds basically say, oh, we should short this thing into oblivion, you know, and try to make, and they're trying to make money. And then you have these researchers that are basically saying, oh, check it out. If they've only got $50 million shorting this thing. If we raise $60 million, then we're going to run them up and then it's going to blow everything out. And you see these crazy things happen. And I think that's where like the Bitcoin fixes this mentality comes in to say, hey, listen, like Bitcoin doesn't have this degenerate component in that regard. I mean, granted, there are some exchanges and stuff that there's people like, I would say, actively shorting Bitcoin, but because the supply issue is so transparent, you know, you have this, this army of people dollar cost averaging into Bitcoin that are basically just taking $20 a week or $100 a week or whatever it is. And they're just buying, and they're gobbling it up. So you have this supply constraint that is completely different than this other stuff. But I'm with you 100%. I think that hard money, hard assets is the only thing to be in right now, because that's the only thing that you can use to protect your lifestyle, you know, and protect your spending habits or whatever there is. Because like there's this meme out there, right? I mean, there's obviously lots of memes. It's 2021. This is all like the year of a meme, I guess. But you know, first they put this information out there saying, oh, inflation's not real. Then they say inflation's gonna be temporary, and they're gonna be like, ah, it's not temporary, it's transitory. Then they're gonna say, it's actually inflation's gonna be good for you. Now inflation's good for you. And now it's like inflation might be worse than we thought. You know, right. And in the meantime, you have these companies like BlackRock that are basically just out there buying up single family houses because they're in the hard asset game too. And then they're turning around and renting those to people. And so there is, I think, inflation creates this sort of race, right? Once the gun goes off, right? It's a multi-lap race, of course, but it's about stamina, staying power and outright speed. But it's like a cross between an obstacle course and a scavenger hunt, you know, because there's all these potential pitfalls out there, but then there's all these potential gains that you can have if you're able to take these assets and you're gobbling them up. And so the people that have the most assets to spend, whether that's a Scaramucci or a BlackRock or just some sort of random whale guy or whatever, a Ray Dalio, these people have these various different, I would say, approaches to it, but you're seeing that in live time now, because you're seeing people gobbling up stocks, gobbling up Bitcoin, gobbling up houses, gobbling up art, all these hard assets that are sort of like delineated by saying, this is a special thing because it's unique, or it's defined and it's one of one or whatever. And it's something that like, it's a physical possession, physical property. And I think Bitcoin obviously has been this sort of like watershed moment for so many people that were traditional investors or defensive investors in the last cycle, like me, that were buying gold and buying these other hard assets because we didn't necessarily trust the liquid markets because of the helicopter money and things like that. Yeah. So now people like me are like just plowing money into Bitcoin and businesses are plowing money into Bitcoin because they're like, hey, we worked our asses off for a decade or 2 decades or 3 decades, and we don't want to see erosion, you know, take place. And we've heard the gun. We know that there's a race now, and we have to accumulate as much Bitcoin or art or homes or you know, land or whatever as we can, so we can either have our own farm or whatever it is. And I think, but unlike all those other things, being a Bitcoin miner is so attractive because then you're achieving some sort of a Bitcoin long haul option in a degree where you're like saying, okay, I'm going to put this much money in and it's going to give me Bitcoin dividends. That's the sort of idea that you have, right? And there's very few, you can't really do that with a farm, in the same sense. You can't buy like $10,000 of a farm and then hope that you get like sent hamburgers, you know, like every couple of weeks. Exactly. But somebody made a joke the other day saying that their frozen beef in their freezer outperformed their stock portfolio because the inflation in beef costs has been so high, you know. And that's these are the kind of things that happen because now it's like we were playing on turbo mode, right? The same rules don't really apply. You can actually jump and throw a fireball at the same time now, like Street Fighter 2 back in the day. Because we're playing in turbo mode and it just becomes detached from reality.
Even talking from a practical standpoint, I mean, because what we're talking about here is very important when it comes to inflation, because not everybody has the ability to plow into hard assets to protect themselves. Most people live paycheck to paycheck. And on a practical basis, you know, houses cost more than they did a year ago. And when I say cost more, it's not like 1-3%. It's like 5-15% higher. Okay. Cars. Okay. A same model car. I mean, you own car.
Yeah. I don't know anything about that. I played the fifth on the car dealership thing.
An F4, you know, an F250, right? How much more is it today versus, if you can even find one, by the way, versus a year ago, right? Right. Talking
20%. Yeah. Like a used car. Yeah. 20%. Yeah. You're seeing used cars that are 2 or 3 years old. And if they're good used trucks or something like that, that has a real utility to it, a function, a diesel truck or a Raptor, that's really cool. Or like a Suburban or something like that. Yeah. They're almost the same price as they were new.
That's
right. So it's crazy because you see this depreciation curve that now has actually, it's come flat. And there was a dip there when people were scared about COVID and stuff like that in March when the market crashed kind of on all assets. But since then, the rocket up, you know, the trampoline effect, because you've seen these supply squeeze issues with chips, and you've seen these sort of these random things. There's not that many more Americans than there were, you know, 2 years ago, that there's that big of a population of people buying stuff, right? But the people that are looking at stuff are saying, hey, I need this. This is a practical serving for me. And therefore they're competing more for it. I think at the same time, you're seeing this like the corporate side, meaning like the CarMaxes and the AutoNations and the Penske's, they're playing a game of supply squeeze bingo, you know, like a hedge fund, because they're publicly traded. So if they need more cash, they can just sell more stock. And as their earnings go up, their stock value goes up. So they sell less stock to get the same amount of effect. And you've seen that with Lithia and some of these other companies where they've driven the market up completely because they have so much cash on hand that they can just go whoop, and they can buy dealerships. They can buy all sorts of stuff all at once. And they're deploying billions of dollars of capital. But anytime you have billions of dollars or trillions of dollars entering into a space, it gets everything screwed up. And the person that gets hurt the most is the consumer, because the consumer that has a loan on a 2-year-old F-250 that he had to pay almost MSRP for, if the market corrects, he's going to lose that 20 or 30% immediately and be underwater. And that's the scam. You know,
let's say that you're between the ages of 55 and 70, and you, like most Americans, are blue collar. Right. Houses cost more and you're either in retirement age or approaching retirement age. Your portfolio, if you have one, by the way, because not everybody has one, not everybody has been saving or can afford to save, is probably mostly bonds that yield nothing. If you even have one, cars cost more, houses cost more, food costs more. How do you retire? Right. How are these people going to retire? It's going to be very difficult. You just have to work more years.
Yeah, because the wages aren't changing that much. The wages aren't going up 30%. There's not 30% for the small business, because the small business doesn't have the ability to borrow the massive amount of money to reinject it back into the business or do like a stock buyback or whatever. Like the small business that has 100 or 200 employees is not a publicly traded company and doesn't have that kind of leverage. So they can't pay their employees that much more. The employees then have to pay themselves more via commission. But then you're, like you said, you're working an extra 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, whatever. And so that idea of retiring, now you have to look further and further out, more remote locations. If you do want to retire, you have to sell your urban property and move further into a rural area where there might be less expensive land, less expensive, you know, stuff or whatever. But generally, when that happens, you're also losing quality of life, because you have less amenities or less doctors or, you know, smaller hospitals or something like that. So there's this really big arbitrage that you have to play when you're approaching that age. And I think the only thing you can do is try to say, hey, like while I'm still earning, while I'm still mining fiat at work, I have to accumulate Bitcoin because it's the only thing that I can do to protect my, you know, myself 10 years from now or 15 years from now. And that's the mentality that I see with a lot of the boomer generation, is that are starting to get it. They see this as, you know, the way the housing boom in the 50s and 60s or 70s and 80s or whatever, how the pricing ramped up to a degree that if you miss the opportunity to get in, like my grandparents at one point had bought a house in Laguna Beach for like $24,000, right? And they sold it for like $250,000 and were like, yeah, we killed it. And it's like that same house today is worth probably $2 or $3 million. Not because it's any functionally better, but just because that's the nature of hard assets that are good quality assets. And yeah. I think that's the lesson that a lot of the boomers have already learned in life. And, you know, they're accumulating whatever they can. The difference is you can't buy one 100,000th of a house, right? You can't buy you can buy $1,000 in Bitcoin, you know, to save you something. And if Bitcoin does go to 100, 200 or a million or whatever it is one day, then your little slice of it, you know, is then going to be, you're going to have so much more buying power than whatever you could have put that money in, you know, in something else. So these are a lot of ifs, obviously, but this is sort of the reason why we're in the Bitcoin business, I guess, if you want to put it that way.
That's exactly right. Well, I think that wraps it for us for today. It was great hanging with you again.
Yeah, dude. I think we covered a lot of ground with the infrastructure bill. I think that I have a lot of hope that this is going to invite a lot of criticism, and because of the criticism and the friction, we're going to have some sort of evolution of the process, and we're going to get more involved as a block of voters or whatever you want to call it. And I think it's not just going to be, you know, companies like Valkyrie going after Gary Gensler saying, when can we get the ETF? It's going to be Bitcoiners that are saying, dude, like local Congress guy that represents my district, please listen, this is important, you know, and let's make it so Bitcoin businesses can move in, things like that. So, yeah, I'm fired up. I haven't been this fired up about an issue in 10 or 15 years, you know, politically. So I think it's great. I think it's great for all of us.
Yeah, I think it is too. I think Americans need to be more involved in politics, period. You know,
yeah.
When we get complacent, that's when we get people that stay in office for 80 years that are out of touch. It's time to recycle.
Cool.
Well, all right. Thanks, CJ.
Steve, great talking to you, man. Once again, thank you for listening. This is CJ Wilson with Stephen McClurg, and this was another episode of the Bitcoin Bottom Line. See you soon. The opinions presented herein are solely of the individual and are not necessarily representative of Valkyrie Investments, Inc. and their affiliates. There is no guarantee that any specific outcome will be achieved. Investments may be speculative, illiquid, and there is a risk of total loss of your investment. Past performance is not indicative of future results.